Welcome to the Bail in the Midwest podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Bail in the Midwest podcast, where we explore a variety of topics related to bail, pretrial release, and the criminal justice system in the Midwest. My name is Shane Rolfe. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Kansas Bail Agents Association, and I've worked in this field for the past 35 years. So today, we're going to do something a little different than normal. While we're normally very supportive of law enforcement, I've said many times that I believe that the criminal justice system is one of the pillars upon which any society is built. But having said that, police are human beings, and like the rest of us, can be flawed. And unfortunately, police, like anyone in a position of power, can abuse that power. And while my personal opinion is that those abuses are more rare than the media would have us think, when they do occur, they have an outsized impact on our society as a whole and the perception of police and the criminal justice system writ large. My guest today has a great deal of experience dealing with the fallout when police cross that line into lawlessness. Jared Fishman is a former federal prosecutor who was involved in a number of harrowing civil rights cases involving the police. He was a prosecutor on the federal case against Michael Slager, a South Carolina police officer who killed Walter Scott, shooting him multiple times in the back and then planting a taser near his body afterwards, which fortunately was caught on bystander video. And more relevant to our conversation today, he was heavily involved in the investigations and prosecutions of a number of incidents of police violence in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. He has a new book out detailing those investigations and prosecutions. The book is titled Fire on the Levee: The Murder of Henry Glover and the Search for Justice After Hurricane Katrina. Jared Fishman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Shane.
Now, I normally give the guests the opportunity to hit the high points of their CV, so feel free to expand on your background, how you came to work in the Department of Justice, and what you're doing now, aside from being a celebrated author.
Well, I started my career working in war zones. I spent time working in Jerusalem, working with Israeli and Palestinian youth leaders, working to build a better system for themselves. When I went to law school, my first job out of law school was working in Kosovo, where I was helping police officers and prosecutors rebuild that system after war. My job at the State Department was to bring American police officers to be a part of a UN contingent of officers serving in Kosovo. My goal all along was to try to work to build a better system. And as I was doing work in Kosovo, one of the prosecutors that I work with told me that if I really wanted to be effective, I needed to be in the system first. And he told me to be a prosecutor. It wasn't something I had really ever considered, but he made the argument that of all the players in the systems, prosecutors are the ones with the most power to influence outcomes and whether or not those outcomes are fair and just or otherwise. And so I took an opportunity to go work as a prosecutor in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. Attorney's Office, where I handled sex offenses and domestic violence crimes. Doing that, it turned out I really liked being a prosecutor and I was good at it. But I wanted to use the power of the office to work on behalf of marginalized communities whose voices are often left out. And so I went to the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, where we enforced federal laws on hate crimes, human trafficking, and police misconduct. And I spent about 14 years of my career doing that until recently when I left to start a nonprofit organization that works with prosecutors and police officers in criminal jurisdictions across the country to use their data and to understand how their systems and processes might be leading to outcomes that they don't want in their communities and to help them fix it.
Working for the State Department in war zone areas or high conflict areas is not a job without risk. One of the guys I went to school with, who was the valedictorian of my class, well, not my class, class 2 years ahead of me, but we played in the football team together, and he was the valedictorian. He took a job with the State Department and died in a plane crash with several other people in the State Department in Africa. So, I mean, working in those areas is not just, oh, hey, I've got this job with the State Department, I'll go over and do this thing. There is risk there, and you're exposed to danger in those things. So, I mean, exposing yourself to that risk is admirable in and of itself.
Well, you know, at the time I was young and naive and maybe didn't think through all of those things. Early in my career, I wanted to answer hard questions. And I figure if you set your mind on how can we answer a hard question about how society functions or a hard question about how humanity functions, then whatever it is that you learned is going to be useful down the road. And for me, countries at war or in conflict were great places to start. It quickly became clear to me that I also wanted to have a family, and living in war zones is not a really great place to try to raise a family. So being able to shift back to domestic work ended up being great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, in the book, and I kind of want to touch on this before we actually get into the book itself, but in the book, when you're talking about your background, you mentioned that civil rights, or maybe it was cases dealing with the color of law, what was a more modern term that was used, but the concept had been around since the 13th century. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. What sort of civil rights did we see come into being around the 13th century? Because civil rights has sort of been a progression from, you know, like the Magna Carta on, where there's been this expansion of rights bestowed upon citizens. So what are we talking about, and say, in the 13th century, where you know, we kind of have the beginning of the civil rights movement, not like we see now, but just expanding those rights to the common people?
Sure. I mean, when we talk about color of law, we're talking about people who are acting under the authority of law. So that can be the police, it can be corrections officers, it can be judges, it can be prosecutors. Our office handled all sorts of investigations into people who were given the authority of law and then somehow abused it by violating someone's constitutional rights. Most typically, the types of cases we do were excessive force by law enforcement. So cases that is considered depriving people of their right to reasonable search and seizures under the Fourth Amendment. Sometimes when we do work in prisons, it's under the Eighth Amendment and the right to be free of cruel and inhumane treatment. Mm-hmm. So depending on what constitutional right is at issue, it can play out in different ways. I can't say that I'm an expert on its 13th century origins, other than to say that in recent American history, that it's been used to hold law enforcement or other people in positions of authority accountable for violating civil rights.
On to your book, Fire on the Levee. First, let me congratulate you on becoming a published author and in hardback, no less. Being published is no small feat. Your publisher did send us a copy of the book, but in truth, I listened to most of it on Audible. I spend at least an hour a day in the car, so I do consume a number of books while driving. Also, my kudos to your narrator as well. I think it was Robert Petkoff. Has a great voice, does a nice job providing emphasis in all the right places. So if you have a voiceover when they do the movie, maybe he can do your voiceover for you, although your voice sounds just fine. Now, in my reading the book, I think it's really like three different books in one. First, it's the true crime story. I mean, a la Helter Skelter. It's a crime and a trial and that sort of thing. Second, it's a memoir of your experiences during all of this, which I think is really quite unique. We don't always get into the head of the prosecutor in these sorts of cases. Normally, they're written from by reporters and stuff like that, and I'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But I think that first person perspective with you as the main author or the main voice in this is really a unique approach in the book. And then third, what has been described by others as sort of a progressive manifesto. Now, just from a book review standpoint, I really did enjoy the first two aspects of the book. But, the progressive manifesto portion didn't really hit home for me, partially because in the field that I'm in, I think the bail industry itself has been kind of subject to some of these, I don't know, progressive attacks on it. But I thought we could maybe talk about the first two acts of the book, aspects of the book, the true crime and the memoir, and maybe we can argue a little bit about the third. So on the true crime,
in ways more than you would imagine.
on the true crime aspect of it, can you just give us the broad strokes of the story, and I'll let you decide how many spoilers you want to insert in here, because we do want people to buy the book. But generally, what happened to Henry Glover?
So in the days immediate after Hurricane Katrina, the city of New Orleans had been devastated. Most of the city sits under sea level. And when the protective levees that normally kept that city dry failed under the hurricane, about 80% of the city flooded. By that point, there weren't that many people left in the city, mostly law enforcement and predominantly lower income people of color who hadn't had the means to evacuate in the storm. One of those people was Henry Glover. In Algiers was one of the parts of New Orleans that actually did not flood and had stayed above water. And so people stayed there a bit longer, thinking that, as in past hurricanes, services were going to quickly return, electricity, cell phone service, and that the city would be going back to normal. Unbeknownst to them, because they were so cut off from the rest of the city, they had no idea about the flooding, and mostly were learning about things through rumor and innuendo. But by about 4 days after the storm, Henry Glover and his family had decided that it was time for them to get out of New Orleans. He had stolen a truck from an abandoned Firestone in order to evacuate him and his family out. A friend had asked him to go pick up some items that they had taken from local stores to aid in their exodus out of the city. And while he did it, he was at this strip mall, and unbeknownst to him, on the second floor of that strip mall was a New Orleans police officer who had been assigned to protect that building. That officer, who had also fired his weapon at another civilian about 150 yards away earlier in that day. And when Henry Glover approached, he asked him to leave. Both Henry Glover and his friend that was with him began to flee the scene, at which point the officer fired a shot from the second floor with his sniper rifle, his personally owned gun. And Henry Glover was shot in the back. When I first got the file, we didn't know that. All we knew was that the human remains of a man named Henry Glover had been found burned in a car behind a levee. And the allegations that had been raised only for the first time 3.5 years later, that the police may have been involved in both the shooting and the burning of his body. We went out to find out if that was true. And ultimately, through our investigation, we found out that Henry Glover had in fact been shot by the police, and the police officers were involved in burning his body and covering it up for 3.5 more years after that.
One thing I think that the book really does do an excellent job at, and that I didn't know or didn't remember, was just really how bad it was in New Orleans after Katrina. I mean, I did the research as I was reading the book and prepping up for this. I didn't realize that, you know, we're well over 1,000 people inside New Orleans died in Katrina. And, you know, we generally here in the Midwest, our big bugaboo is tornadoes. And so even in a horrible tornado, like the tornado in Joplin that flattened a big section of the city, I think maybe 20 people died. I mean, there were several other injured and stuff like that. And you know, you have some small town that gets flattened, but, you know, you maybe have a handful of people that die. 1,000 people is just mind boggling.
Yeah. It was 1,800 people.
And
I believe those are the most up-to-date numbers coming out of New Orleans. And all of those people are people with their own unique stories and lived experiences. And one of the things that I tried to do in this book was to humanize all of the people and to try to explain their rationales and their mindset as best I understood it from the evidence that I got or from my conversations with those people, both from the eye of people who were victimized by the police, and the same for the police officers themselves who were committing these crimes. I think way too often, both in true crime and as well as the way that we talk about criminals or we talk about the justice system, is these are people. These are people who are making decisions oftentimes with a lot of other factors. And in the case of this, it's under the duress of a massive storm that upended society in very fundamental ways. And part of the reason why I think this is an interesting story is it shows what happens when our society breaks down. We should be incredibly cautious of what happens when the rule of law collapses and what that can mean, both from civilians and from law enforcement. But for me, each of these people in this book, and they're all real people, have various different motivations and incentives and structures and partners that they're involved in. And I think all of those influence ultimate outcomes in this case. And we should be both very conscious of the role of individual choice, but also the role that systems and structures can play in how humans choose to respond under duress.
Yeah, I mean, the total anarchy in that. Sometimes you forget just how close we are to that line at different times. I mean, and sometimes you see the movies about the floods and, you know, the small town, and everybody's got their sandbags that they're throwing, trying to keep everything back. And other times you have the dystopian approach to things where, you know, it breaks down and people are like, whatever, you know, I'm going to get what's mine. I'm going to get, you know, or I'm going to get out of here.
And I think both of those were true of New Orleans. I mean, there's plenty of stories of heroism that came out of those storms. There are a lot of people, including people I prosecuted for doing really bad things under those circumstances, who also did heroic things.
Right.
And I think it's important to remember that we're usually not all good or all bad. We're usually a little bit of both, and who we hang out with and the circumstances that we find ourselves in can really push us one way or the other.
But, you know, hanging out with the wrong people can really get you in trouble.
And similarly, hanging out with the right people can really help you both advance your career and add to your happiness and improve outcomes. You know, I run an organization and I try to make it clear to my own staff, I need you to hold me accountable. I need you to speak up when I'm doing something stupid, because who is most likely to see it? It's going to be the people closest to us. And if we want to live lives consistent with our values, when all of us fall short of those values, we want to know that we have people nearby who are gonna hold us to account and straighten us up.
Well, most bosses don't appreciate that particular attitude all that much.
What do you mean? Listen, I mean, I think we've been running businesses wrong. I think we've been running governments wrong. I think we've been running a lot of things. If we want to accomplish the things that we want in our society, you can only do it through cooperation and through partnerships and alliances, people who can help you do the things that you're not good at, to help you do the things that you can't do on your own. That's the only way that we can achieve things that are greater than ourselves. And the only way to do that is to surround yourselves with people who are going to hold you to that standard.
All right. So let's talk about David Warren. He's probably, in my mind, the least sympathetic character in this, you know, scenario here. As near as I can tell, he should have never been a police officer. The only people I've seen become police officers at 40, mid 30s, one, either the people that came out of the military. So they spent their 15, 20 years in the military, and, you know, they moved from one military organization to a paramilitary organization, or two, people that are taking those jobs to work in corrections. We're just going to work in the jail. It's a whole different world when you're out patrolling the street, and particularly if you're patrolling the street in a high crime area and in an area that you're not necessarily familiar with. I mean, it takes a certain mindset to be a cop and a certain background. And my understanding is Mr. Warren was originally from Wisconsin.
Right. And okay. with multiple higher level degrees in engineering and business. Yeah, he was, I believe, 40, 41 when he became a police officer, and he had moved from running his small family business into being a police officer. And part of the reason why he wanted to do that was he liked guns, and it was one of the reasons he was originally recommended to be a police officer from a mentor who ran a shooting range and shooting training, and said to Warren, you like guns, why don't you go be a police officer? And he had reached a level of professional stability that he was able to do that.
Yeah, that was probably bad advice. You know, I think my experience and opinion is, while guns are important to police work because you have to defend yourself and defend others, that's not the right mindset to go into problem-solving situations, which police are called upon to do all the time. I mean, you come into a volatile situation and you need to get control of that situation, but not necessarily get in that control of that situation by killing someone or, you know, using a gun, and actually using it on anything other than, you know, okay, I'm going to draw this gun so everybody's protected. But it just seems like that's the wrong mindset. Did the New Orleans Police Department, do you know, did they have any sort of psychological screening for officers coming in?
I believe there was. I'm not sure whether or not one. I never saw one with David Warren as an example. So I know at some point earlier they were doing it, but I believe they stopped. But I could be wrong on that one. But for sure, I mean, there's a real. I think there's often a problem when you see some problematic police departments. Comes down to who they are recruiting to be those patrol officers. Right. There are departments that emphasize, whether it's directly or indirectly through the photographs they use, showing SWAT teams busting down doors, showing, you know, active shooter situations as a big part of how they're promoting that job. And when that becomes a bigger part of their HR recruitment push, you get more people like David Warren who are into it to bash down doors and kick down doors. Right. There's other departments who emphasize their role as community guardians, and they'll show pictures of their police officers serving their community, handing out water. There's police departments that really promote their ability to solve crimes. When you hold yourself out in the image that policing projects, is going to attract similarly minded people. And so I think as we think about policing reform and change in America and the role that police officers are going to continue to play in keeping our communities safe, I think we need to think about how we are finding those people to make sure that they have the skill sets that we need to do things like solve complex homicides. You know, it's a different world today in terms of the tools that are available, the ways that we can go about thoughtfully addressing public safety than it used to be. And we should be recruiting police officers with that skill set who want to grow into that. Every once in a while, you see the departments that want to bash down doors. And when that is who you're recruiting, you're going to see a much more warrior-mindsetted police department, which often leads to these escalations. One of the big problems that I've seen, you know, I've worked in a lot of police departments over the years, and I've studied many of their training. How officers are trained and how they are recruited is going to play a huge role in the outcomes that we see. And so being more thoughtful, you know, police departments spend a lot of time shooting guns. They sort of spend a lot of time learning how to do it safely. They've got, you know, regular certifications that they need to do. And this is absolutely important. If they are going to hold on to a weapon that can cause the death of a civilian, we definitely want to make sure they know how to use it properly. But the reality is that's a rather small percentage of their interactions with civilians. Right. And what we also equally need to be able to train them is, how do you de-escalate a situation? How do you make sure that the right backup comes in? One of the things that we see in policing in a lot of different places in America is that they're the front lines in enforcing our mental health issues in America. Like, that's who we turn to. Someone with mental health or housing instability that's wandering around a community, either potentially causing a threat or at the very least making people a lot of uncomfortable. The people we usually send are the police. And more often than not, they're the wrong people to send. And so thinking through how we can deal with people who really understand mental health, who understand the difference between bipolar and schizophrenia, who understand threat assessments, most of the officers that we're sending out there are in their early 20s. That's who a lot of people are. And they're not trained on this. They don't have the skill sets to really assess those situations. So I think that's something we need to work on.
Part of that, you know, the argument seems to be made, and I don't think it resonates with a lot of people, is you're not going to do a curbside encounter session with that person. If the person is in a way that's violent or unsafe to other people around, the police have to be there to get that situation under control, and therapy and treatment and stuff like that can come after that person is under control. We had a situation where a kid we had on bond, his mother called the police and said, you know, he's throwing knives at me. Obviously, he had a mental health issue. And this was right when my area was trying to do a ride-along program with mental health providers. That since is, you know, they've modified it since then, largely because of things like this. And they told her, oh, that's a mental health issue. We can't come. We can't respond to that. You know, call your bondsman. And so they call us and go, hey, you know, he's throwing knives at me. I need you to come pick him up. And like, can you not just call the police on that? I mean, he is assaulting you with a weapon. It seems like the sort of thing that there should be a police response to. And that, well, they said they wouldn't come. And we called the police and said, what's the deal? No, that's a mental health issue. It's like, all right. And so I had to send my people out there to pick him up and revoke his bond to place him back into custody so they could then get him into appropriate mental health. But that seemed like that would have been a better response for the police to respond to under that situation than to call us, which we may not be available 24/7.
Sure. But when you really look at the span of mental health interactions that police are coming into contact with every year, obviously it's a spectrum ranging from a person who's talking to themselves and wandering out without their pants on and people throwing knives. I mean, I think I agree with you. When there's an imminent public safety issue, which sometimes there are, certainly, then yes, we need to use the police. A lot of times, that's not the case. And it would be great for communities to have other responses. But it's also not just the initial arrest. I mean, I hear this from police officers all the time. I can't leave this guy there, but my only option is to bring him to jail. Those are my two choices. And as someone who I prosecuted cases with underlying mental health issues, our criminal justice system is supposed to hold people morally accountable. We punish them for a violation of our moral code as much as anything. And right. What I saw in so many of these mental health cases is we can't hold this person morally culpable. This person isn't necessarily making choices about what they do. I had this one case where a man definitely had schizophrenia. He had nowhere to live. And every time he kept getting arrested, he would go back to his grandmother's house. But he scared his grandmother. And so the grandmother got a protective order. And sure enough, he got released from jail and he went back to the only place he knew, which was grandma's house. And so yet again, he enters the system. And part of the reason he kept entering the system was that there was no one else to help him. And I think that's really the core to a lot of our problems, is there is no place in most communities to send people. Our justice system is not the right place. Our jails and prisons are not the right place most of the time. But communities don't have adequate alternatives. And I think that is really the next phase to how do we build safer society, is having alternatives that make sense for the problems that we're facing.
Well, and I sort of came of age during the Reagan presidency. But one of the things that I think you can put squarely in his lap is the defunding of a lot of federal grants for mental health, you know, facilities. And I think you ended up dumping a number of people out of facilities that needed mental health treatment that were just on the street. And then they get handed off to the police and they get handed off to the jails because there's no other option on where to deal with people that really can't be out in, you know, I hate to say polite society, but, you know, are a danger to the community, but not a huge danger to where it's like, oh, you know, if we don't put this person in jail, somebody's going to go to prison. But, you know, he's showing up and he's breaking in the house to take some food from somebody, you know, just the sort of public order stuff that we need to have control over. But do we necessarily need to send them off to prison for an aggravated burglary or something like that?
Right, because it's really expensive. I mean, I think it's one thing that people don't talk enough about is how expensive it is to try to solve our problem that way. It is really expensive to incarcerate someone for a year in America.
Sure.
And if our goal is that when they get out, which inevitably most people will, 95% of the people who are locked up come back to our societies, I think our goal should be to make sure that they can not return. We should be looking at how do we stabilize people so that they're not breaking into cars, they're not beating their spouses, they're not creating a danger to our communities.
Well, I know that in Kansas, so I'll just plug my friend Stephen Owens, who's in the legislature. I know that the legislature has for the last couple of years been looking at how to get more mental health resources to people in the criminal justice system, whether they should be in the criminal justice system or whether getting that mental health, diverting them out of the criminal justice system as well. So there is a push that's in, you know, that's trying to get that mental health issue addressed a little bit more. Before we get too far off, and let's kind of get back to your book here. Next character I kind of wanted to talk about was Greg McRae, because he was a character that clearly, other than the killing of Glover, you know, committed the most horrific act in here, and it was the burning of the body. So, spoiler alert, you know, that's he's the one that burned the body and admitted that. But I thought that he was poorly served by his initial lawyer and probably wasn't able to raise, you know, the mental, again, as we're talking mental health, the mental health defenses that his attorney probably should have raised at the time. And I don't know if that was Mr. DeSalvo, I think, was representing him at first. And what I got, and I really, as far as the book, I really, really, really liked the epilogue that you put in place where you interviewed some of the characters from the book. Here we are, you know, we're 10, 15 years later and talking to McRae and DeSalvo. And I mean, obviously DeSalvo wasn't a wealth of information, but McRae, I thought, even as bad as things were with him, I thought he came off as aside from the Glover family and the actual victims, but of all the police involvement, I thought he was potentially the most sympathetic in there, not because of what he did. He did what he did. He paid the price for what he did. But I mean, raising the PTSD type defense, because I did read some of the other cases, and I know that on the appeal and the resentencing and some of that other stuff, he tried to raise that up and the judge is like, yeah, whatever. You know, that was a trial issue. We're not dealing with that now. You almost wonder if DeSalvo, because DeSalvo mentioned that he'd never lost a police case, you know, until until you and the New Orleans case came along, and then he lost two or three. You kind of wonder if he didn't go, hey, no issues. You didn't intentionally do any of this federal civil rights stuff. You know, if they should be charging it through state court, we'll beat this at trial. So we don't really need to bring these types of defenses. And then when he didn't beat it at trial, it turns out he probably should have raised those PTSD defenses.
Yeah, I mean, I always found McRae a very interesting character in all the years that I worked this case, because I think he did something horrific. He yes. burned Henry Glover's body, burned William Tanner's car without any justification. Of the 1,800 people who died in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, only one person was burned, and that was Henry Glover, and he'd been killed by the police. You know, as you mentioned earlier, one of the real challenges is linking the burning to the shooting and who knew what when. And I think, there are a lot of unsatisfactory answers, notwithstanding the fact that I tried to figure that out really hard over the course of the last 14 years and used a lot of resources to do it. I know what Greg McRae's position is, and I don't fully accept that as being true. But at the same hand, I do recognize him as a heavily traumatized person. When we look at a lot of police misconduct in the country, one thing that you can look at and repeatedly see a correlation between misconduct is trauma and exposure to trauma. This is true not only of police officers, this is true of all humans. The more adverse events people have in their childhood, the more adverse events people have in their professional careers, the more trauma they are exposed to, the more likely they are going to have future bad outcomes if that trauma goes unaddressed. And that is as true of police officers as it is for anyone. Greg McRae had been exposed to amazing amounts of trauma, both as a line officer when he was policing dangerous neighborhoods and getting shot at. He was exposed to that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, being exposed to lots of dead bodies. But at the same time, he was also an unstinting team player. He was a cop's cop through and through. And he was very much directed by his higher ups. I think sometimes when we see policing, we have officers who are very much having to judge on the spot, making good decisions for themselves, and really adapting to the situation they're dealt with. And then in other parts, we see a more hierarchical command structure where you just do as what you're told and you don't ask any questions. McRae was a part of that system as well, and he would do the things he was told and he wouldn't ask a whole lot of questions. So how much of that was used by the police department to protect other officers? As I raise in the book, I believe that one of the things that DeSalvo was doing in poorly serving McRae as a lawyer was protecting the police department. I continue to believe that to this day. I think the evidence is well established. Now, does that mean that McRae didn't do something bad? No. I mean, what McRae comes out ultimately when I'd wanted to talk to him for years. I'd been trying to talk to him during the investigation. I wanted to talk to him after the investigation. And it was only after he was released from prison that we were able to speak for the first time. And McRae confirmed what I knew all along, which was that this cover-up was way higher and went far higher up the police department than anything we could ever prove in court.
Right. Well, no, and I think had you found the witnesses, or had someone been willing to talk or willing to square that circle to say that there was actually that direct relationship between the shooting of Glover and the burning of his body to cover up the evidence, then I think all the verdicts from the first trial were that was, guilty on Warren and McCabe and McRae and the original sentencing on all those individuals, I think those would have stood. I think it was just not, whether it was the police department did a good enough job in keeping quiet or whether McRae was telling the truth and it was a PTSD reaction. And again, I think that those initial verdicts would have stood had that connection been able to come through in trial. And just that's my take on reading ever through.
Well, and I think so too. And I think one thing to remember is it wasn't for lack of talking to every single police officer in the 4th District and in special operations. I mean, we interviewed every single one. This is not a half-assed investigation designed to protect the police. We interviewed those people and virtually, scores and scores of people said, I don't know anything. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. And of course, we were operating with the handicap of being there 3.5-4 years later. We had the additional impediment of people saying it was Katrina. I don't remember. I was stressed out. I didn't get enough sleep. which was true. That doesn't mean that people didn't know what happened. And when you see this, you know, you talk about surrounding yourself with people who can either, you know, help you do good things or help you do bad things. The culture of the department was, we're going to keep quiet and we're not going to cooperate with the feds and we'll see if they can put anything together. And I think it, you know, this book and this story and what we were able to uncover is a testament to persistence, as opposed to, and the few people who did come forward, because ultimately there were a number of police officers, some of whom were culpable themselves, some of whom just witnessed, some of whom were bystanders, almost all of whom were silenced for many, many years, for some obvious and not obvious reasons. But ultimately, it was the persistence and the few voices of people who did step up that were able to reveal what we were able to reveal.
Well, and you were additionally, and again, I'm not criticizing your investigation at all. I think you did a great job of identifying the half-assed investigation which did occur, which came from the, you know, internal affairs, or I think it was Detective, you know, Duguay. Am I pronouncing the name right?
Yeah.
That, you know, the investigation's there, but you were also working with the additional handicap of the burning of the body, which destroyed a great deal of physical evidence. I there's a blurb on your cover from David Simon, and I'll probably reference that later if we don't run out of time. But I believe in his book Homicide, the homicide detectives that he was embedded with during that book said that their hardest cases to try and solve were what they referred to as crispy critters, you know, bodies that had been burned up in houses or in arson things, because so much of the physical evidence was gone. You couldn't, absent like a bullet through the skull, you couldn't even tell if they'd been murdered or not. And so the working with the handicap of a burned body just increases that even more, which also lends credence to the cover-up scenario. That, you know, what better way to destroy physical evidence that could be used against you in the future?
And on top of that, in addition to that, I mean, police departments normally produce an inordinate amount of evidence.
Right.
They've got radio logs, they've got shift rosters, they've got, you know, the recordings, and now there's body cameras, and there's a lot of reporting that goes up. In the aftermath of Katrina, virtually none of this existed. There weren't recordings of radio calls. Shift rosters didn't exist. People were acting on the fly, trying to do their best. And so normally the first thing we would do in a case is collect all of that. And what we were learning was, number one, most of it didn't exist. And the stuff that did exist seemed to be created to further help cover up what happens.
So let's, since this is a three-part book, it's not three sections, but they're all kind of woven together. So let's kind of move on to the memoir section of this, because, and this, I'll get a little geeky on this here, but as a note, I think that the memoir aspect of the book was really the most unique part of this as a true crime novel. It's written with a first person narrative, which is kind of a different narrative structure for a true crime novel, I guess, true crime book, since it's not a novel. So the first person narrative is more the classic detective story told entirely from the point of view of the detective, so that the audience or the reader only knows what the detective knows and really only hears the thoughts of the lead character. And in this case, that was you. I realize this is a little bit of writing geekery here, but can you kind of explain why you chose this format to tell the story?
I knew it was an interesting whodunit. I mean, I think that was part of what initially attracted me to the story was we had this mysterious burned body. There was allegations that the police were involved, and we had to piece it together piece by piece under really difficult situations where there was the absence of evidence, where it was the burned body. I want to bring people to this story because I think people need to understand more of what's happening in our justice system at large. What are some of the challenges of policing in America? What are some of the challenges facing our justice system as a whole? And I thought this story was a very good vehicle for keeping people interested. You know, there's a lot of people who don't really read about the justice system, who don't really know much more than what they hear in the newspapers. And I thought this story gave me a chance to educate more people about some of the problems facing our society, because, you know, at the end of the day, my goal is to try to fix some of those things to the extent that we can. And I thought this story allowed people to do it. You know, I wanted to tell it from my perspective, and I wanted to keep the reader along as I was figuring things out, because this is both me figuring out the crime, but it's also the story of a young idealistic prosecutor learning that a lot of the things that I had been taught in law schools, a lot of the things that I had believed and how I'd been taught over the years just weren't right. And I want people to learn along with me. I think it's an interesting story. I think there are really interesting characters. When you talk about omniscient versus semi-omniscient versus first person, like, this is definitely a first person story, and it's coming through with my perspective. And I make it clear at the beginning, this is my perspective. I think I am the person with the deepest knowledge of what happened, because I have spoken to more people about this case firsthand, both back in 2009 through the trials and then onward. I've reviewed all the documents. I know this case file more than anyone. And so I feel like I can tell a more omniscient perspective on it, at least as people have purported their own version of the story and their own perspectives. But at the end of the day, I'm a guy trying to figure it out like everyone else, with my own limitations, and want to be able to tell this story as completely as I can, recognizing those limitations.
So, and from the memoir perspective, I really did like the way you kind of wove in some of your prior experiences, the discussions about your time in Israel and the time in Morocco and the time in the Balkans. It really does help flesh you out as a character, even though you're a real person, you still have to flesh out your background and your motivations in a book like this. And so giving that personal history and kind of knowing some of that personal history, I think really helps, you know, I guess, humanize you, if we're talking about humanizing, you know, people involved in the story. But it gives us an idea of some of your background and some of your perspective and your worldview coming into this. So I think that was a good choice in how you wrote that up. The one thing that would be a problem for that would be that, you know, when you make the movie out of this, you know, then whoever plays you as the actor is going to be in virtually every scene. And so sometimes actors get a little worked up about having to work that hard.
Well, I just hope they choose someone really good looking.
Oh, well, me, yeah. Cary Grant's not available. That was a personal joke here. We were playing with some video on that. Now, I mentioned David Simon earlier and that there was an endorsement blurb on the Dust Cover book. And one of the things that he mentions in that book, aside from the arson stuff, is he notices over time that the more time he spends with the homicide detectives, the more time he spends in that environment, he finds himself becoming more callous. I think that one of the stories was he was at a cocktail party with a bunch of his friends who were, you know, in the, I guess what we in the Midwest might call the Left Coast Liberal Society. And he is telling a story and laughing about something, and they're looking at him and they're just horrified. And it sort of, you know, gives him back this, wait, how far off the rails have I gone being associated with? So I'm kind of curious how this experience prosecuting police officers, how it's changed you. Are you more cynical or more idealistic, you know, more or less driven, you know, given that your experiences and your exposure to all this? Because, I mean, this is really the worst side of policing that you get to see.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to ask me before I started writing this book, had I been traumatized by my experiences working with abusive police officers and seeing countless autopsy photos over the course of my career, I would have said no, I wasn't traumatized. I've worked with lots of traumatized people. I've seen the impact that violence has had on their families. I've seen the impact that a lot of the harm has had on their family. And so I would always judge myself from the perspective of people who I saw being truly traumatized. But it was only in writing this book that I think I was beginning to come to grips just how much being exposed to death and violence and destruction and a system that was itself callous. That had a huge effect on me. When I worked in the Middle East and when I was working in war zones, one of the things that you see in war zones all the time is black humor. People telling jokes about destruction as a way to somehow come to grips with the horrors that they're dealing with. I think the same is true in law enforcement, and you can see it play out again. All of these things are spectrums, from people who engage in really toxic machismo conversations that I think are very disturbing, to people just being callous and feeling disempowered. I can't do anything. This is the way they are. This is the way it's meant to be. And I think everything in between. And so certainly I was subject to that just like everyone else. And part of why I think I made it more of a memoir was to help me come to grips with the implications of all these things.
Now, you did mention, just in kind of close out your the memoir portion, you mentioned sort of in passing of some of the difficulties that you were having in your marriage. And I think that anybody that's hard driven, that spends a lot of time away from the home or at work and kind of suffers through these things. But being in a long distance relationship, I know it's not a long distance, you're still able to go back home, but you were away a lot, particularly when your kids were young and a lot of this burden shifted to your wife. It seemed like this was sort of mentioned in passing, and maybe this was, I may have missed it because this is part of the book I was listening to rather than reading, but hopefully you guys are able to work through that and everything's good now that you're, working, hopefully you're working less far away from home in what.
Yes, no. My wife and I are still together. We just celebrated our 18th anniversary with our two daughters. It was really hard. I think part of writing this book was also to help us work through some of the issues that maybe went unspoken. A lot of times when you see the true detective version of this, there's often like the fights and the husbands away. Like we were actually much more, I think, supportive of each other. But that's not to minimize the challenge of being away and the burden of raising one's family. I think it's something to remember and to be honest with, because I know in my office, we didn't spend enough time talking about the implications of doing these cases on our families, what that meant for a caregiver who may have been at home. We certainly didn't spend a lot of time talking about the impact of trauma on ourselves. And so, to stand up against injustice, to take on problematic policing or taking on anyone who is victimizing their community, whether that's sex traffickers. There's plenty of disturbing stuff I saw when I was doing sex trafficking and labor trafficking cases. Same is true with hate crimes. They take a toll on us emotionally, but then they also take a toll on our families. And so part of thinking about how do we do effective crime fighting means we have to support the people on the front lines. That includes the police officers, that includes the prosecutors. And I think it also means supporting their families, which far too often we don't do.
Well, and it's very easy in a relationship to, for one party to feel like, all this other stuff is being prioritized over them. I mean, just from my perspective, you get a phone call. I mean, I don't have to do it quite so much anymore, but when I was, or just starting doing this, it's like any time the phone rang, oh, sorry, dinner's over. I got to go. I've got to go down and do this thing. And so, but that was the nature of the business done. And you're going to be in the same situation. Police are going to be in the same situation. It's like, unfortunately, this job takes priority over the relationship, and just, I don't know, it's tough to get through.
And it's particularly hard when you believe that job is noble. When you are a person fighting on behalf of the rights of whoever's rights that is, whether that's people accused, whether that's the rights of victims, whether or not, whoever it is, right? It is a noble job. We're trying to help make our communities safer. We're trying to help make our communities more fair. We're trying to keep a sense of order and calm in our communities. And so at the same time, I'm trying to raise a family. I want my kids to be happy and well-adjusted. I want them to be prepared to go out and succeed in the world, which is also an incredibly noble goal. And I think where some of the hardest parts are is when those two noble goals come into conflict, because you can only be in one place at the same time.
So since we're running out of time here, let's move on to the Progressive Manifesto, and we'll kind of just hit on the top of that, because I'll try and pick out the part that I did like about the Progressive Manifesto aspect of it. Because there were parts that's like, man, I'm just not going to finish reading this. Like, I know we're going to talk, but it's like, just, so I'm like, I'm in my own bubble and I don't agree with some of this. But after I finished the book and really thought about some of the issues you raised, the us versus them concerns about the police and other groups in war zones or hostile areas. I mean, anything can be tribal. And race is just one readily visible parsing of groups. It struck me that left and right, and that's capital L, capital R, especially on social media, but increasingly in public life, are definitely in us versus them camps. And I don't know that this bodes well for the long-term survival of a multicultural society. And whatever we think of, what we have, it is a multicultural society. You spent time in the Balkans, which is where we get the term Balkanization, which is, breaking down into individual groups. So how does this us versus them mindset bode for the future, just as the country as a whole?
I mean, I'm certainly worried. I think there's a number. I think the country is becoming more polarized on a lot of different levels, politics, religion. People are getting their news sources from much more like-minded sources. So what we see is we rarely have shared access to information. It's not that we couldn't. You know, the irony of the internet is we actually have access to more different ideas than has ever been possible. And yet people are actually more limited in where they are learning and what sources they turn to for a source of knowledge. That to me is very scary. And part of the reason why we do a lot of work at the local level is I don't have a lot of optimism about our ability to solve some of these problems at a national level. I just think our politics are too divided into us and them that it's not a realistic solution to a lot of our problems. The good news for people who care about criminal justice and care about public safety is most of those decisions and most of the leaders making those decisions are happening at the county level or at the city level, sometimes at the state level. But it is a local decision, and local people get to make a choice. How do they want to be policed? How do they want their justice system to function? And I believe that we can solve these problems. I work in jurisdictions with an elected Republican official in Charleston, South Carolina, and I work in jurisdictions with Democrat officials. In most of those jurisdictions, the politics are not Republican versus Democrat. Usually it's very single party rule these days in a lot of the places. Right. And what are the barriers to solving these problems can be more personal. They can be lack of communications. They can be lack of resources. But when we bring people together and really try to talk at a high level of what do we think our system should do? What are the outcomes that we want? I think people can solve these problems. Oftentimes, because there's so many different players, even the powerful actors like the prosecutors feel like their hands are tied. Oh, my hands are tied by the defendants. My hands are tied by the judges. I don't have power to influence things. The reality is part of what we help people do is understanding the power that they do to improve on the things that we can improve right now without having to change laws. And I've really gotten grown to systems thinking, which is this idea that if we want to understand our outcomes, we need to understand how the different parts of our system interact with each other. But this is also not a system that's just running like a computer on its own. They're people. Right. And so, you know, when we talk about things like backlogs that are happening since courts closed down in COVID, or we're talking about cases entering our system that really have no business being in our system either because of they're really mental health cases, or maybe the evidence just isn't there and we shouldn't be bringing those cases into the system. We can solve these problems. It just takes bringing the right people together to have the right conversations. And one thing that I have found that is uplifting as I've traveled around the country is that most communities agree with me when I say they want to live in a safe community and they want their government to be fair. That, I think, is a fairly universal truth that I've seen in both right-leaning and left-leaning jurisdictions. And if we can start from that as our premise, the question should be, are we accomplishing those things? We have not had the ability to analyze our collective decisions at a macro level ever before. But one of the things that we do at Justice Innovation Lab is use data from real places to help them make better decisions that are in line with the outcomes and the values that they're trying to perpetuate.
Okay, so just, I know we're getting short on time, but let me hit a couple of points here real quick and we'll wrap this up. One of the things about the book that really strikes me is it strikes me, and this probably wasn't your intent, and it's probably coming from my perspective, but this is an argument for bail. It is a bail podcast, so we should probably at least touch on bail. But if the police are corrupt, and clearly I think you demonstrate very well that in New Orleans the police were corrupt on probably a fairly large scale, then bail itself, the option of bail, is often the only chance a falsely accused person has to get out pending trial. Most people don't seem to realize that the alternative to a secured bail system is not that everybody goes free. Rather, it's a system like the federal system that relies heavily on preventive detention. And, you know, as you mentioned in the book, the general population in reaction to increasing crime typically responds in draconian fashion. I mean, trading freedom for safety, to paraphrase Ben Franklin. So I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on bail as a civil right. Non-excessive bail is guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, and most states guarantee a right to bail in some fashion as protection against government overreach.
So, you know, I think I step back again from a bit of a macro level. I don't think anyone should be held pre-trial unless they are a danger to community. Our Constitution presumes innocence until proven guilty. And I think people, the default assumption should be that people are free to go pending these cases. And I listened to one of your podcasts talking about the history of bail and the circuit judges going around and how it could take years before a case is heard. That's still the case. In places that we're looking, it's taking 2, 3, 4 years for a case to go through the process. And I think that either we've got to speed that up significantly so people can get speedy trials, which they're also being denied. But I don't think people should be held unless there is a true public safety component. You know, a lot of times we talk about this failure to appear. And I think there's different ways to thinking about failure to appear in court. There's the people who are absconding, and obviously we want to prevent that. But what I've seen is a lot of people who fail to appear are working 2 jobs. They can't take 2 buses. They're having status hearings all the time, and they can't disrupt their work. Like, we don't want that either. And then of course, there's the people who just forget about it because they don't have a good way of being notified. That's why a lot of the court notifications, I think, are a very effective way to ensure appearances. People who need to be held to account, we need to make sure they show up, and we need to make sure that if they're a danger to the community, that they are not released into the public. I think as a whole, we hold way too many people. And the question is, what is the right mechanism for ensuring their relief? I think when you look at the types of cases that are in the system, a lot of them nonviolent in places that I've worked, a lot of them low-level crimes, I don't think that people should be able to buy their release, meaning that the lowest, that the people with wealth are able to buy their freedom and the people without wealth cannot buy their freedom. We should not have a system that exists like that. If what we care about is ensuring attendance in court, then we need to make sure that the what is necessary to get people in court are available. And to the extent that people need to be detained, whether we call it preventative detention, I don't think putting $1 million bond on a murderer that they can't afford is any different than preventative detention. And so I think what we need to be is honest about what we are trying to accomplish. And that should be that we should hold people pre-trial as little as possible, unless vitally necessary for government interest. And I think where we agree is that historically, one of the ways that we've done that is bail. And so if bail can serve as a tool to free people up, then that should be something we should use. I think way too often what I've seen in courts are people who should be released on their personal recognizance because they're not a threat to the community and they're not unlikely to appear, still get hit with a large bail that they have to find a portion of money to pay for. We look at a lot of cases that shouldn't be in the system in the first place. We did work in Charleston, South Carolina. 1 in 4 of those cases got dismissed for insufficient evidence. All of those people had a bond. And to the extent that they had a bondsman to help secure their freedom, none of that money they ever got back. Right. So they ultimately did get their freedom. They paid, you know, I think it was millions of dollars for people who were ultimately released from the system. To me, that seems totally unfair as a way to run our society. And so how do we ensure that people are freed, that they are held accountable, that they show up to court, and that we are, you know, creating? And I think bond is one of those solutions. I think there's other, you know, I think there's other possible ways. And I hope that one day we can study it and look at what's working and what's not working so that we can build a system that ensures people's rights and liberties and also keeps communities safe.
Okay. Well, let's wrap it up here. I know we're past our hour, but we'll wrap this up here. The subtitle of your book is The Search for Justice After Hurricane Katrina. So given that, I'll kind of give you the last word here. Can you define what you mean by justice? Is it retribution? Is it punishment? Is this a reversion back to the Ware Guild of the Anglo-Saxons and the restorative justice, you know, component? What do you think we need to do to move to a more just society, you know, in searching out this justice?
To me, justice is as much forward looking as it is backwards looking. I think what our criminal justice system has become is a system of punishment as opposed to justice. And I've sent enough people to prison over the years to know that we should never mistake punishment for justice. What I think is necessary is that when we see these harms that are happening over and over again, that we begin to think much more holistically about how do we prevent them? How do we peel the traumas of our societies? How do we ensure that we address our homelessness and poverty issues that contribute to this? How do we better address mental health? To me, justice is a forward-looking process that is about building a better society for ourselves, for our children, for our grandchildren, so that people can live in a safe and fair community, which is what I think everyone wants.
My guest today was Jared Fishman. The book is Fire on the Levee, The Murder of Henry Glover and the Search for Justice After Hurricane Katrina. It is also available in an audio version that is equally compelling and well narrated. I highly recommend reading or listening to it. Mr. Fishman, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Shane.
Fire on the Levee, The Murder of Henry Glover and the Search for Justice After Hurricane Katrina is available on Amazon.com and book retailers everywhere. Join us again next time for the Bail in the Midwest podcast.